Protocol, a key part of the Brexit agreement that Prime Minister Boris Johnson reached with the EU in 2019. On Wednesday, Brexit Minister David Frost issued a new command paper that would radically revamp the Northern Ireland Protocol, which he himself negotiated. Frost's new proposal was rejected by the EU, with the European Commission saying that we will not agree to a renegotiation of the protocol. The Northern Ireland Protocol is a main component of the Brexit withdrawal agreement, whose main goal is to maintain an open land border between Britain's Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in order to facilitate the free movement of goods. The protocol, which only came into force in January, has led to additional checks and delays on goods entering Northern Ireland from Britain. Joining us now is our correspondent, Jerome Hughes, who's with us from Brussels. Jerome, how far apart are the EU and the UK on the issue of Northern Ireland?
There's no doubt, Bardier, that they are very far apart, and really there's no sign right now of any hope in terms of them coming to some sort of a resolution. I mean, from the UK side, they're saying it's unacceptable that this Northern Ireland Protocol is creating so much friction in terms of goods that are moving from Britain to Northern Ireland. And what the European Commission is saying is that, look, we are willing to examine any proposals and look at them in good faith, but it has to be within the parameters of the Northern Ireland Protocol. That the Northern Ireland Protocol is effectively the only show in town. It's an international agreement. Both sides knew exactly what was in it. And now you have a situation whereby the UK government is rowing backwards. And when you speak to senior officials here in Brussels, they have this feeling that, you know, Boris Johnson's arrogance is somewhat being fueled by the fact that he has such a big majority in Parliament. You remember the 2019 landslide victory that he had during the general election, and actually increased the number of seats, Tory seats, by 48. And now they have a majority of 80 seats in the House of Commons. And before that, you had Theresa May's government, which was being propped up by the DUP. So Northern Ireland unionists had a big say in what went on. In fact, they were able to scupper an agreement she reached with Brussels because they felt that there was a situation where there was this status being given to Northern Ireland, and effectively it made them less British. They consider themselves completely British. They don't want anything that aligns themselves more closely with the Republic of Ireland and the EU vis-a-vis the rest of the UK. And so they had power when Theresa May was in power. But with Boris Johnson, they don't have that. So Boris Johnson is able to, he feels he's very politically strong. And on paper, there's no doubt about that he is. But unionists feel disenfranchised. And the European Union considers Boris Johnson and his government to be completely unreliable, completely untrustworthy, that anything that they actually do agree that, you know, the UK side could back down at any point. And you've never seen relations so bad between the EU and the UK. Don't forget, it's not that long ago the UK was a member of the European Union, a strong member of the EU. Now they just look more and more like enemies. And, you know, one of the bad situations here, it could be a situation whereby you could have an all-out trade war between the EU and the UK. But perhaps the worst-case scenario, Bardier, would be if we saw a situation of violence breaking out in Northern Ireland, because the patience of unionists is running out. OK, we don't have a hard border yet between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but even so, this fact that this status has been given to Northern Ireland, which just differentiates it from the rest of the UK, unionists just are not happy about that at all.
All right, thanks a lot, Jerome Hughes, joining us from Brussels. Well, joining us, journalist and political commentator Saïd Mohsenabbas, joining us from the British capital, London. And also writer and political analyst John White is joining us from Edinburgh. Well, let's start off with Mr. Saïd Mohsenabbas from the British capital, London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to Spotlight. Britain has demanded that the EU overhauls the Northern Ireland Protocol just a year after it was agreed. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the NI Protocol?
I think because partly your reporter said that there is an arrogance and there's a sense that Britain can do what it likes within this government that they have in office at the moment. It's very, very unrealistic. But they are constantly pushing and hustling for breaking of more and more rules and regulations that they've agreed to. I mean, this has become a track record You know, the latest one, it's obviously laughably starting off with a row over sausages, but that's kind of a red herring. You know, there was been a whole situation where the proposed ban on fresh British, Great British sausages in Northern Ireland could effectively be, you know, banned. But that's a bit of a red herring, because there are, according to Northern Ireland businesses themselves, much bigger problems that are looming. And, you know, even though this ban is due to take effect, or this protocol is due to take effect in October, it seems that these looming problems are increasing. And the central one is the amount of administration needed for actually shifting food from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. Of course, they're meant to do the checks now at the Northern Ireland border, which prevented them that happening at the Northern Ireland Ireland border, which actually, of course, has disturbed the unionists as well, those people who don't want to see any shifting of the relationship of Northern Ireland with Britain. So they've started murmuring, of course, saying that you know, anything that looks like they have to be creating any kind of nominal border between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland, for them, is a red line. And so, of course, there have been allegations of threats being made to people in the kind of the export sort of section there on the coastlines. But in reality, it's kind of a perfect storm that people are arguing is building up. But normally, I mean, food products entering the single market require a complicated piece of administration, and that's known as the Export Health Certificate, EHC. But supermarkets currently don't need those for most products moving from GB to Northern Ireland. That's due to change in October, which will effectively be part of a perfect storm. And that's what people are really worried about. What are the consequences of this, really, as to what will happen beyond October?
Let's cross over to John White in Edinburgh. Mr. White, the EU, they immediately rejected the call coming from Britain, saying that Britain needed to respect its international obligations, and pointed out that it had been negotiated by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. This wasn't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why doesn't London want to honor its own handiwork?
Well, a government that fails or refuses to abide by its obligations enshrined in internationally binding agreements instantly becomes a government of a pariah state, and that's what Brexit has ushered into being. Britain is now a pariah state. Boris Johnson lied in the run-up to the 2019 election when he said there will be frictionless trade between the EU and the island of Ireland, and now he is sowing dragon's teeth. He is trying to play to his newly acquired red wall working class base in the deindustrialised north and midlands of England and South Wales, and he's going to dial up the xenophobia, the anti-Europe xenophobia, the base British nationalism. Look out for the Churchillian rhetoric and the references to the Second World War. This is a government of rogues, and it's a government of rogues brought into being by a nation of sheep, in the words of Edward R. Murrow. The EU is doing nothing wrong here. It's only asking for the UK government led by Boris Johnson, to abide by its agreement. There was no coercion. There was no sleight of hand. It was agreed in the context of the Brexit negotiations in 2018-2019. And the Britain already is trying to break those agreements in order to assuage a unionist rump in the north of Ireland that has nothing to offer the people of that province, other than sectarianism, other than bigotry. That is where we are now.
Simplicity Abbas, let's go over some comments from the British Business Secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, said on Thursday, a deal is a deal, but it wasn't something that was going to last forever. He also claimed the agreement wasn't written in stone. Well, they don't write agreements in stone anymore. It was written into international law. Unpack these comments for us, please.
Again, it's slithery comments. They're kind of really get out techniques which politicians use very, very regularly when they don't want to abide by international rule of law. You see, of course, Donald Trump, Britain's partner across the West Asia, has been breaking these laws. It's become a kind of a precedent that's been set, unilaterally pulling out of trade deals, not agreeing things. I mean, it seems like Britain definitely is catching that habit from the Americans. And I think the problem with what they're doing, of course, is added to what's going on with COVID-19 and the exodus of a lot of the immigrant workforce at the ground level. What you're seeing is a dangerous accumulation of factors which could actually impact on supplies to supermarkets in Britain. I mean, if they continue as they are, what with this kind of business with Brexit and adding to the problems that they potentially got, there are already murmurings that the army may be on standby to have to deliver certain foods, because a lot of the vegetables and the market places is suffering because of potential lack of drivers even being able to take products goods. So the last thing Britain really needs is more headaches like this. But under the protocol, it was agreed that Northern Ireland would continue to follow EU rules on product standards to prevent checks along the border. Checks would instead take place on goods entering Northern Ireland, as I said. But the bottom line is the agreement, the British government is clearly trying to renege on all of this. They want a complete new negotiation. The EU is saying, we're not having any of it. What we've got in terms of the protocol, we're going to do everything within those boundaries. There is an Article 16 locked within the protocol, which does allow for some flexibility in terms of extenuating circumstances that may arise due to economics and other factors. But and funny enough, the EU almost exercised Article 16 in terms of changing some of the agreement they had within this protocol, and they did that over COVID-19, the passing of COVID-19 vaccines. In the end, they pulled back pretty sharpish because there was a bit of a hue and cry. So Europe didn't go for it, but Britain certainly is. They're trying to trigger this Article 16, saying, look, it's part of the protocol that we're allowed to do this. But the game behind this really is more of a we don't care about Europe. And I think that in the long run, this isolationism that Britain seems to be heading in terms of at least with Europe will only make their own trading more and more difficult, given the constant threat of COVID-19 new strains coming out all the time, shutdowns of the economy, closures of the high streets, etc.
Mr. White in Edinburgh, Boris Johnson's government, he's warned that it will suspend parts of the agreement if the EU doesn't budge. The EU has threatened trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks his promises. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of what many are labeling right now as a mini trade war?
Yes, but this will play politically into the hands of Boris Johnson and his administration, because this will dial up the anti-Europe xenophobia. This will play into the hands of the narrative that Britain has been put upon by this monolithic, tyrannical Brussels bureaucracy, and this will play well with the Brexit heartlands that has propelled him into power in 2019 and continues to maintain his popularity regardless of all the scandals and the crises ushered into being by his failed policy on Brexit, on COVID. So Boris Johnson will seek to extrapolate as much political capital from this as possible. Brexit was always an emotionally driven political project. It was never about reason, it was never about rationality, it was never about bread and butter issues. It was all about a supposed reach, emotional reach back in time to a golden age where Britain ruled the waves, Britannia ruled the waves, and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. Boris Johnson has more political acumen than his detractors would have us believe, and he understands base nationalism is a very, very powerful, powerful political force, and he's going to play to that in regards to his opposition to the EU on the Northern Ireland protocol.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. White. The rising cost of Brexit for Britain was divulged on Thursday as a new analysis showed quitting the EU had delivered an £18 billion blow to UK trade in goods. Now, if this impasse does continue, how will this affect the British economy?
well, it will obviously affect it deleteriously, but this was never about economics, as I just said. This was all about emotion. It was about the legitimization of far-right tropes regarding British identity, immigration, and the representation and meaning of British history. It is the acme of British mythologies regarding British history and regarding Britain's place in the world. So it's never about been about economics, it's been about base nationalism, and it's a very, very dangerous motive force indeed.
Mr. Abbas, Ireland, it isn't where the line is drawn, pun intended there, as Gibraltar remains an issue in post-Brexit talks. Gibraltar's border with Spain, like that between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, is a divide between the EU and a non-EU Britain. What if the provisions of that temporary deal between the UK and Spain come into question?
Well, that does flare up very regularly, and I think it's being kept in check because of wheeling and dealing and behind-the-scenes negotiations. So it's still very much a vulnerable area, just as the Northern Ireland situation is. These are all flashpoints, and one does get the feeling that somebody somewhere certainly is quite happy to engineer these flashpoints, because all of this would bring back the old rule Britannia kind of mentality. And that is something which the Tories have definitely been stoking. They would be quite happy with Britain having a kind of a nationalistic, if you like, outlook and being more united. Don't forget that they're also internally battling the idea of Scottish independence, and the idea of Welsh independence has reared its head, and that the Scottish independence certainly hasn't gone away. In fact, it's gathering more pace. So Boris would need anything he can to try and sort of keep Britain together, because there's, of course, that threat of fragmentation of Britain due to Brexit, because the Scots aren't terribly happy with the way that England is certainly approaching the whole Brexit question. So yes, there are many, many issues which are really about territorial fragmentation, which Boris is risking as well. He would say that actually he's creating a rallying cry for a unified United Kingdom, and they're all for this kind of bringing back the old jingoism of empire days, almost, if they could. I mean, if it was down to Boris, he certainly would, but there's a limit to what they can do. It's manifesting on the street, of course, in Islamophobia, in a rise in racism. You saw, even with the English football players just recently, that the minute the English football players missed a bunch of penalties, and they happened to be black, there was a huge storm on social media, in which there were racists who came out very openly attacking those black players. And of course, there's been a response, and it doesn't mean that everybody in Britain is racist, but this issue of xenophobia, this issue of racism, this issue of nationalism, as my colleague pointed out, is a major factor in winning political votes in the heartlands. And so perhaps that is more important to Boris than Britain's economic future. He probably won't be here when the real consequences of Brexit kick in, which will be that Britain will certainly not have as much wealth passing through it as it did, given the trade it had with the EU.
Let's get a final thought from Mr. White. Is Boris Johnson's recent Asian presence, both the diplomacy push and also the announced South China Sea military deployments, do you think they're intended to divert attention from some of these post-Brexit uncertainties?
Absolutely. This is the politics of mass distraction. This is desperation. This is an attempt by Boris Johnson to assert Britain's stature on the world stage post-Brexit, trying to hark back to the ghosts of Britain's imperial past. But the great Labour leftist Nye Bevan said it best. A reactionary is a man walking backwards with his face to the future. I can think of no better summation of Brexit in our time. Britain is a post-colonial theme park, a 19th century post-colonial theme park, and in poetic irony, rather than ushering a new golden age for British imperial prestige on a world stage, it has only ushered in the coming breakup of the UK. And when that day comes, such a cry of freedom will ring out around the world, such as never been heard before.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London, and also thanks to writer and political analyst John White, speaking to us from Edinburgh. Also thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed.
This Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. But the people divided their religion among them into sects, each faction in what it has rejoicing. So leave them in their confusion for a time.
Brothers and sisters, in the previous program, we talked about the 53rd verse of the chapter. فَتَقَطَّعُوا أَمْرَهُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ زُبُرًا كُلُّ حِزْبٍ بِمَا لَدَيْهِمْ فَرِحٌ. Preceding this verse was 52nd, which talked about the unity of different prophets, different nations existing before us. From the divine perspective and point of view, they are all regarded as one. But one important warning was mentioned in 53rd verse. فَتَقَطَّعُوا أَمْرَهُمْ بَيْنَهُمْ. People have cut off their affair of unity between them into different sects. We concluded that this state of division is arising from egotism and narcissism. And these two traits are the greatest enemies to arriving at ultimate truth for the mankind. The Holy Quran says about the polytheists of Noah's age in chapter Noah, the 7th verse. وَإِنِّي كُلَّمَا دَعَوْتُهُمْ لِتَغْفِرَ لَهُمْ جَعَلُوا أَصَابِعَهُمْ فِي آذَانِهِمْ. And verily, whenever I call unto them that you may pardon them, they thrust their fingers into their ears. وَاسْتَغْشَوْا ثِيَابَهُمْ. And cover themselves with their garments. وَأَصَرُوا وَاسْتَكْبَرُوا اسْتِكْبَارًا. And persist in their refusal and magnify themselves with them. So when this state of prejudice persists, man becomes close to the path of truth, and instead he becomes obstinate and headstrong in his own view and will not accept anything or anyone else, lest a truth apparently other than what he believes will be disclosed to him.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine.
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The next verse, however, says, فَذَرْهُمْ فِي غَمْرَتِهِمْ حَتَّى حِينَ, but leave them in their overwhelming ignorance for a while. The worst kind of misleading is when Allah leaves man to his own devices. فَذَرْهُمْ, but leave them. And the reason to that is clear. Disagreement and division is leading to the abyss of perdition. And this is what brings down the anger of Allah and His prophets, disagreement or division. But people have cut off their affairs. So, result, ذَرْهُمْ فِي غَمْرَتِهِمْ حَتَّى حِينَ, leave them in their overwhelming ignorance for a while. This verse implies that when such is the case, one should leave them be in their ignorance, in their negligence and confusion, till the time of their death approaches. And that's the time when they will see the truth, or on the day of judgment, they will face the divine punishment, because such people have no fate other than that. And interestingly, the verse says, حَتَّى حِينَ. This Quranic word, حِينَ, refers to the time of their death or the time of their punishment or both. And the word ghamra means to destroy the effect of something, and the meaning of the word is extended to the sense of ignorance and the troubles that overwhelm man. So in the verse, the word means ignorance and negligence and misguidance and somehow confusion. So ذَرْهُمْ فِي غَمْرَتِهِمْ حَتَّى حِينَ, leave them in their overwhelming ignorance for a time. 2 points regarding this small verse, dear listeners. The first is that it says فِي غَمْرَتِهِمْ, their overwhelming ignorance. It somehow implies that they are the reasons for their own misfortune and their own troubles. They are the reasons to their own confusion and negligence. They are the ones who did this to themselves. The second point is that the verse says حَتَّى حِينَ. It seems that those people, those ignorant people, do not have a long deadline ahead of them. And the Almighty Allah's punishment awaits them when they're dead, when they're approaching their death. But these ignorant people have also different thoughts in their minds, which completely proves that they lack common sense. We will, inshallah, refer to that in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key. Unwind all the secrets, this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard.
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him. With all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him is very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages. The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear, trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice. In April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved a second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis, Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after Number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They are there to protect big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Saeed Forizam, London.
For thousands of years, the Nile River has meant life to people in a largely arid region. But today, the river is associated with an endless dispute. Ethiopia said on Monday that it had attained its second-year target for filling a mega-dam on the Blue Nile, the Nile River's main tributary. The country said the plant may start generating power in the next few months.
We are now putting the turbines of what we call Unit 10. As soon as some important works are completed in a few months, it's all about connecting it to the transformers. And this will provide the biggest outcome of this work for the people of Ethiopia, which is generating electric power.
The project, called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has been at the center of a regional dispute since Ethiopia broke ground on the project in 2011. Egypt, a dry land home to nearly 100 million people, depends on the Nile for 97% of its water supply. And Sudan views the dam as a threat to its own dams and water stations, but Ethiopia deems the project essential for its development. A decade of negotiations under the auspices of the African Union has failed to result in a deal on the dam's filling and operations. The UN Security Council met earlier this month to discuss the project, but Ethiopia later slammed the session as an unhelpful distraction from the AU-led process. Experts say foreign powers' intervention throughout the years has only aggravated tensions in the region, and that an African approach to the problem is needed.
I think
think the problem is the intervention of the imperialist countries, particularly the United States at this stage. So what has to happen is a more Pan-African approach to this problem. Sudan and Egypt should sit down with Ethiopia and negotiate a policy which will benefit all three countries.
Once completed, the $4 billion project will produce more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, doubling Ethiopia's power output. This is significant for an economy that frequently faces electricity shortages and is sometimes hobbled by power rationing. But Egypt considers the dam as a threat to its existence, and Sudan has warned that millions of lives will be at great risk if Ethiopia unilaterally fills the dam. Is a war between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia brewing on the Nile? The next few months might show if tensions explode into yet another hot conflict in the war-stricken continent.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe, the floods you've mentioned, droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which about has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian documentary film Life Among War Flags, which focuses on Afghanistan and the Taliban, directed by Mohsen Islamzadeh and produced by Press TV, has been unveiled in Tehran in the presence of the filmmakers. The documentary movie Life Among War Flags narrates a different story of conflicts between armed groups in Afghanistan. Moreover, it has made research on the role of the Afghan government in such conflicts.
I have been making documentaries for about 17 years now. The Life Among War Flags depicts the story of people whose region is controlled sometimes by the Taliban, sometimes by Daesh, and sometimes by a central Afghan government and the US forces. I believe they are the main victims of the war in Afghanistan. Making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group. The documentary film Life Among War Flags takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the Rule of Law report include Bulgaria, Croatia and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. Via Skype, former Portuguese MEP Ana Gomes says that the group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel.
MEK pays people to participate in their events. So my question is, how much has Prime Minister Janša been paid by MEK?
Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual Rule of Law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the U.S. and some of its Western allies, including the U.K., have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming it as, quote, fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The UK, a major US ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the US and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the US and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
The village of Vaux-sur-Chèvremont on the outskirts of Liège has been devastated. Seven people lost their lives in last week's floods here. Hundreds have been forced to flee their homes.
When the water comes, I see it in my foot. I say, well, okay, we go home. But the water not in my foot come here, and I don't know what to say.
Meteorologists claim 2 months' rain fell here in just 2 days. It's being described as the worst natural disaster for eastern Belgium and western Germany in living memory. However, how natural is it? Climate change is being blamed. Also, there is criticism surrounding planning. Many towns and villages in Europe were constructed on floodplains. Some residents have been told it could be up to 8 months before their homes will be habitable again.
We lost our fridge. We don't even know where he is. He disappeared in the river. Everything is damaged. We have to do everything again.
There was also severe flooding in Netherlands, France and Luxembourg, but there's no doubt Germany and Belgium were hit hardest. Many thousands of homes that were not destroyed are still without electricity, water and gas supplies. It might take weeks before those are restored. Aside from the tragic loss of life, the floods have caused billions of euro worth of damage. Serious questions surround the effectiveness of the EU's flood warning system. Reviews will now be conducted to find out if all this human suffering could have been avoided.
When we get out of the house was the worst moment, because we have the feeling that we have lost everything and left it there and don't save anything.
The European Commission says it stands ready to provide whatever assistance is required. Throughout Tuesday, flags will be flown at half-mast in Belgium as the country observes a national day of mourning. Jerome Hughes in the village of Vaux-sur-Chèvremont, Belgium.
The morning of Eid al-Adha, Yemenis from all walks of life came together in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to call on the international community to redouble efforts to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade imposed on the country.
We are here for the sixth Eid, demonstrating in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The international body has not fulfilled its duty towards the Yemeni people. More than 6 years have passed and we have been subjected to an absurd war that killed thousands of Yemenis. We demand the international community to lift the siege imposed on the Yemeni people and release the oil ships that have already obtained entry permits by the United Nations.
Protesters blasted the United Nations for remaining silent toward the Saudi suffocating siege on Yemen. They called on the international community to take real measures to stop the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.